Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And this is the New Statesman podcast. Well, it is mere hours until voting opens in a variety of elections across England, Wales, Northern Ireland, Scotland, and the Police and Crime Commissioner election, Stephen.
Yep, I'm excited about all of them. This is actually the first time outside of a referendum or a general election year that everyone in the United Kingdom is voting in some election since 1968.
Top party chat.
Yeah.
To provide more of such top party chat, Henry Zeffen, our acting Staggers editor, joins us as well. I'm going to start actually, Henry, by asking a bit about PMQs, which I missed. Was it illuminating?
No, it was profoundly unedifying. So it was interesting tactically, in as much as David Cameron, for the first time in some years, really switched it from questions to the Prime Minister to questions to the Leader of the Opposition. So he used a sort of contrived question from a Tory backbencher which linked local elections in Lincoln and Hamas he contrived to use that. Exactly.
What was the segue there?
It was Carl McCartney is the MP for Lincoln and his Labour predecessor from 2010 is chief executive of the British Board of Deputies of British Jews.
Oh.
And somewhere sort of in that sort of muddle, he found an excuse to give David Cameron the opportunity to ask Jeremy Corbyn to condemn what he said some years ago, which is when he described Hamas and Hezbollah as his friends.
What I would love to have been is a fly on the wall in the Tory whip's office, right? So obviously that's a planted question, and you always plant questions in your own side to help or hinder you.
But what were the other alternatives?
So they were literally sitting there just being like, right, so we need to get from A to Hamas. I just would have loved to see the chart which eventually led to producing Carl McCartney. Like,
Carmarthenshire is in need of a new railway. And does the Prime Minister agree with me that Hamas would not build such a railway? Yeah. That's one of the weird things about PMQs, isn't it? Is that sense of the stage managing it. It does actually give a huge advantage to the Prime Minister.
Yeah. I mean, I'm less surprised that Corbyn failed to come up with a sort of adequate or adequately deflecting response to David Cameron, who asked that sort of question three or four times, than I am that he didn't talk about refugees. So this is the second week in a row since the Alf Dubs amendment about child refugees in the House of Lords has been an ongoing sore for the government over whether it's going to let in unaccompanied child refugees in Europe, let them into the UK. And the second week in a row where you'd have thought that's very obvious Jeremy Corbyn territory.
Second defeat for the government, right?
And the second defeat for the government, exactly.
Parliamentary ping pong. It came to the Commons and it was defeated. But it's been twice through the Lords.
Yeah.
First, Alf Dubs, who was himself was on the kinder transport out of Prague at the age of six, he suggested we should take 3,000. And then people said, well, that's actually committing to finance, so actually it's not the Lords' purview. So he then said an unspecified number. But the SNP's Angus Robertson raised it, didn't
exactly.
He?
And for the second week in a row and again. And what's so bizarre about Jeremy Corbyn not raising it is that it had been briefed in advance that David Cameron was going to climb down, and all that Corbyn did by not asking a question about it was he allowed the victory to look like it was Angus Robertson's rather than his own. I mean, if Jeremy Corbyn had asked six questions about it, he would have elicited the climb down from David Cameron over the course of that six.
The biggest loser here, apart from I suppose Al Dubs is very... I had 1 week in Westminster. He's such a nice... I was going to say old man, which sounds really patronising, but he's 80
years old.
You know, Yvette Cooper must be quite... I mean, as much as Yvette Cooper is given to outbursts of violent emotions, because she has really been one of the people who's pressing on this. She leads Labour's refugee task force. Next time you see her in Stoke Newington Organic Bakery...
I mean, I don't ever actually talk, and also now I make my own bread. I don't... I am becoming more of a cliche.
Yeah, I was going to say, the answer to the question, what could make Stephen more Stoke Newington?
Anyway, moving on from my own bread. Yeah, I mean, I think it confirms as the one remaining defender of the old new approach to PMQs, then I think it shows one of the reasons why it was very foolish to abandon his attempt to change it. I think people liked that. It was part of the new style he promised. And also, he doesn't think on his feet. You know, that there is just no two ways about it. Corbyn does not respond well to Cameron throwing something new into it. And the other clever thing is it always put Cameron in the loser's corner, because if he introduces this character, Cameron doesn't know anything about, like, whether or not...
Rosie from Stevenage.
Yeah, what if she dies at the end of the story? I mean, yeah, that's the thing. What if in the sixth question Rosie dies?
And also because, like, you can't, like, go, well, he gives us stuff about what Rosie thinks. Because one thing you can't do is kind of look kind of contemptuous of voters, of... ordinary, hard-working families.
Whereas you can look contemptuous of other politicians as much as you want, and I think that is... I still think that they should bring the new old system back.
Well, let's enter Hostage to Fortune Corner, also known as Election Predictions. So there's been this weird ongoing thing this week of Jeremy Corbyn kind of got trapped into saying that he didn't think Labour would lose any council seats. Now, I think... Seamus Milne, his spokesman, has said that may have been misinterpreted by reporting it as said in a classic mainstream media lies as ever. Mm-hmm. But he is in this difficult position in that all the polls are predicting, what, 120 losses in English council
seats.
Yeah,
if you extrapolate through Railings and Thrasher, what you get is losing 100 to 170. But the problem is he's not in a difficult position, right? If you lose council seats as the opposition... it is a sign you are going to go down, not just to defeat, but to a crushing. The opposition has only lost council seats net in two occasions since the last rearrange, because it's quite difficult to compare like for like once you get past 74. In 1982, which obviously presaged landslide defeat, and in 1985, which presaged landslide defeat.
And the other thing about 1985 is that's not even a great comparator, because even though Neil Kinnock's Labour lost council seats, they lost fewer council seats than the Conservative government, which I don't think we're expecting the Conservatives to do this time. So they went backwards, but they went backwards to a lesser
backwards
extent. The Conservatives.
85 was the kind of SDP's
exactly.
Sort of, well, they thought at the time that it was their kind of
Are
revival.
You saying,
but
Stephen,
it
actually had not...
SDP fight back,
that you're actually, not expecting
as Tim Farron might have said.
The Lib Dems to make huge gains this
time. I mean, that's why I think then. So the thing is, it's very easy to say what a bad night for Labour would be. It is a losing council seat. However, lots of Corbyn's critics have tried to put a figure on what would be a good number of gains, which I think is a little bit trying to set a bar that he then wouldn't be able to hit even if things were going well. Yeah. Because we don't know yet whether or not... I'm quite sceptical of whether or not this Lib Dem revival is actually a thing. But this is the last set of local elections contested before UKIP were a factor, so they complicate your net gains. And we don't know if the Lib Dems... will do well. What you ought to look out for to know whether or not it has been a good or a bad night for Labour is if they are consolidating and winning in places like Redditch, Swindon, Milton Keynes, basically if they are winning in marginal seats. My impression from talking to people on the ground in those seats is the Conservatives will hold on and in fact make gains, which
is the kind of the story of the 2015 election, which is Labour gaining votes, you know, piling up bigger majorities in London, but not winning the Tory marginals that it needed.
Well, there's an interesting kind of long term, and I think one of the many problems in Labour discourse is that the party is divided between people who think that Corbyn is like, I don't know, like a 16th century monarch who can cure scrofula or whatever, and then a group of people, and this I think includes most left-wing commentators, most of whom thought that Ed Miliband was going to win the last election, who basically think that getting back to an electable Labour Party is getting back to the party which got crushed in the 2015 election. Actually, Labour has fairly large underlying problems that kind of do not begin or end with Jeremy Corbyn's leadership election. In 2005, they fought a very efficient election where they got very few votes, but they were in exactly the right place. In 2015, they wasted lots of votes, and it looks like they are basically gaining votes in, like, the liberal bits of Bristol, parts of Norwich, bits of London.
Can I bring up something else that will upset people who, you know, believe as I do that austerity politics have been harmful and sometimes counterproductive, which is that Kezia Dugdale in Scotland is going to Holyrood elections with an explicitly anti-austerity message. I mean, whatever kind of juggling you want to do, the only way to stop cuts is to raise taxes. you know, you have to do one or the other. The budget has got to kind of, you know, if a certain amount of money comes in, a certain amount of money comes out, you've got to change one of those two things. And so she wants to put a penny on income tax across the board and restore the 50p tax rate. That's probably going to lead to her coming, if not third, then a dicey second. The SNP are going to gain more seats against that. I mean, there is a point here which will just to upset our Scottish listeners, that the SNP have essentially become New Labour at this point, and that it's very difficult for new Labour to fight against that. But I think that if the lesson the membership should really look at Scotland and say, you know, actually, people hate New Labour, yes, but actually they would probably vote for a very New Labour set of policies right now.
Scotland is a very good example of how Corbyn's presence as leader is actually going to complicate the sort of post-match analysis after Thursday rather than give an obvious reason for why Labour might be doing badly in certain areas. So Jeremy Corbyn, and if not him explicitly, but many of his supporters, said during the leadership contest his anti-austerity platform is the way to win back Scotland. That was always nonsense. Scottish Labour has been a mess for a long time. You had MPs who had what they thought were unassailable majorities getting crushed in 2015 because they hadn't campaigned for about 30 years. They didn't know where the Labour voters in their seat were. It's had sixth leader in 8 years. So there's all sorts of long-term difficulties there. And it probably is the case that if Labour come third on Thursday, or have come third when you're listening to this, it's not Jeremy Corbyn's fault in the slightest. But by making the promise that was never going to be delivered, that there was a silver bullet for winning back Scotland, which simply showed a total miscomprehension of the basis of SNP support, he's given a lot of people who supported Ed Miliband, as Stephen says, a way out of the kind of actual deep thinking that they need to do about, which is, how is Labour going to win back? You know, without Corbyn, Labour was still in a mess in Scotland. Without Corbyn, Labour still might have done quite badly in these council elections. Sadiq Khan's victory has very little to do with the Labour Party, or Sadiq Khan's presumptive victory will have very little to do with the Labour Party or Corbyn.
But isn't the problem for Labour is, I mean, I think I wrote this when I went to Worcester, is that it's got enemies on so many different fronts, right? Mm. And actually each one of them requires a different message to win back those voters. So in its northern, it's losing votes to UKIP, yeah. And in places like Kent, somewhere like Thurrock, you know, that those are problems throughout, you know, in some of the south outside London. Elsewhere it's losing votes to the Scottish Nationalists, who have their own various different reasons. In some places, you know, it lost votes to the Lib Dems even. There is no one ideology. You know, you can't say Labour needs to move left or Labour needs to move right. What it kind of just needs to do is have an entire... Like, it needs to sort of sweep the pieces off the board altogether. I was thinking about Trident. So in Trident, this is a great situation in Scotland. So Kezia Dugdale herself believes in multilateral disarmament. The Scottish Labour Party's official position is unilateral disarmament, which accords with the position held by Jeremy Corbyn personally, but the official position of the Labour Party overall is now multilateral disarmament. And that's just an example of how difficult it is to try and craft a message that is... You know, the SNP have in some ways got a much simpler job because they don't have to craft a message for English marginals.
I mean, on Trident, I think this is one of the many issues on which Corbyn's critics need to keep their mouths firmly shut to win even more friends among podcast listeners. This idea that a lot of people have on the centre-left or right, or whatever you want to call it, of the Labour Party, then, oh, we have a conference session. No, your Prime Minister designates policy towards the deterrent is de facto your policy. If Jeremy Corbyn is Prime Minister in 2020, Britain will have disarmed, whether or not it is still paying X amount a year towards Trident. It's, you know, it's a bit like if I pay the rentals on, I don't know, my gun, but I leave my gun in a locked box. Do I have a gun when I go into the office? No, of course not.
That's so deep, I don't understand.
I also, yeah.
You're leaving your gun in the office before you come and sit next to me.
Yeah, you have a gun now?
No, but hypothetically, if I don't have it on me, then am I armed? No.
You're absolutely right. The moderates, or centre-left, or whatever you want to call them, obsession with official party policy is just a charade. I mean, when Tony Blair was Prime Minister and leader of the Labour Party, they didn't say to him, "Oh, you can't make a big policy speech announcing something to do with academies. You have to wait till September party conference and put it through a series of binding resolutions which have come up through the National Policy Forum." Of course they didn't, because he's leader of the Labour Party. He had that mandate, and he was Prime Minister. He had that mandate.
Also, a bit of the election that most people will, you know, the bit of the election that most people watch that connects with most TV viewers are the leaders' debates. So it's entirely pointless to, you know, people are going to ask Jeremy Corbyn his opinion, even if he says it's only my personal opinion. This is what Labour Party policy is. It doesn't matter. That's the bit that people are going to hear. This, I'm voting for Jeremy Corbyn.
The perverse thing in Scotland, and I think you're completely right, that Labour has the problem that all social democratic parties do in Europe, than they are, actually with the exception of Renzi in Italy and Trudeau in Canada, than they are losing votes to
all
comers,
not led by gorgeous men.
To all sides. I mean, you know, if I wanted to continue alienating as many people, I would point out that the only two flourishing left-wing parties in the world are led by Blairites. But, you know, maybe, yeah, like, I mean, like, yeah, like...
No, you're absolutely right. So Matteo Renzi is as reforming a social democrat as Italy has pretty much ever had. Yeah. And he came from pretty much nowhere. He's mayor of Florence, and used that to rise up the poll. Justin Trudeau is a slightly complicating example because he is part of a political dynasty there. But but apparently people like his viral mini cool things, so...
He knows about quantum computing, and he's got a very...
No, he learned about quantum computing so that he could get all the retweets.
Yeah, but I kind of feel like this is the thing, isn't it? Even if you go there, obviously that was a Craven stunt where he sort of suggested to the press that they should ask him about quantum computing so we could go like, oh, it doesn't rely on bits like Norton 1. It's actually more complicated than that. At least he managed to do that. Imagine Ed Miliband planting a question about quantum computing and then explaining quantum computing to you.
I mean, I kind of feel like if we'd had Twitter and YouTube in 1997, this is just Tony Blair, right? And we know how people felt about him 10 years later, the people who got swept away by it. So, you know.
Okay, this is a Blair like exception zone. You're allowed to say Tony Blair in this space. He's not.
I do, but I'm just pointing out to the Trudeau fanatics who might not be Trudeau fanatics in 10 years.
He's probably not going to invade Iraq.
But that is the other thing about Trudeau and Renzi, isn't basically... Every left-wing party is either in a position where it didn't try third-way Blairism or Clintonism the first time, and it can still try it again, and it works for them, but it doesn't work a second time. Or they're in the position where, basically, everything you might say, wouldn't it be great if the Labour Party did X, you can find a European example of the Labour Party doing that and ending up on exactly the Labour Party's present trajectory, which is to get a vote share in the mid-20s.
Okay, here's a question that will upset some listeners. Would you describe yourself as a Blairite?
No, because Blairism was a political solution to... One, it was a setting when you had a finance sector which allowed you to cream off X amount of revenue every year. Politics is a lot harder on the left than it was when Blairism was a thing. I mean, let's take kind of the four things which it would be great for Labour to be able to do to win again. Getting the votes of the elderly. In 1997, most pensioners in Britain lived in poverty, right? The most lasting redistribution of the Blair government was dragging pensioners as a grouping out of poverty. And they are the only group who are being protected adequately by the coalition, because they vote. Sorry, by the Conservatives. However, does the Labour Party want to go into the next election competing with the Tories for taking money away from the young and giving it to the old? Of course they don't. But they are going to have to get some votes from the old if they want to do anything for the young. So they're kind of stuffed there. On the economy, Blair and Brown didn't have to raise taxes, apart from in 2001 when they did it, because incomes were going up by a record level. Literally all of the political trade-offs that allowed Blairism to work as an electoral force don't work now. I mean, the fundamental insight that the voters are never wrong is eternal, but...
What were the other two? You said there were four things. So one is... The old people, two is the economy, and there were two more.
Oh, the third it was...
No social media?
Yeah, no social media. And this, like...
I think you can have an Alistair Campbell-style control grid when you can control the media.
Like, this thing is just like... Alistair Campbell could seriously damage newspapers by going, well, you've done this, so we're denying you access. Because they then only found out and they had a story and they didn't have the next day. Mm. Whereas now, yeah, I mean, we saw this with Ed Miliband's attempts to punish various media outlets. Yeah, what would happen is and they wouldn't give it to something. It would appear on, you know, the New Statesman website, the Mirror website, and then 2 minutes later it would be on the Telegraph or the Times website. It's not really an effective form of punishment anymore. So that whole approach to politics doesn't really work. And then the fourth is just in the international situation is a lot more fraught and difficult. It was fairly easy to have a situation in which you could be fairly loudly proud of the benefits of letting people immigrate, globalization, etc., when everyone was getting more wealthy. It's much harder to do that now.
Russia's definitely more feisty than it was in the 1990s. I mean, China has got a growing middle class who all want to consume things. And
Iraq happened, right?
The fact that it happened
means that
we now can't have a sensible conversation about Syria. Well, exactly. From our post-Blairite safe space, that's probably enough for now. We'll catch up with it again after all the results. Who knows? We might be sitting here next week hanging our heads in shame as Labour storm to victory, taking 300 council seats. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And we host the pop culture podcast from the New Statesman, Seriously.
If you secretly care more about comics than Jeremy Corbyn, this is the podcast for you.
You can find all our episodes at newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
And now it's time to go down the line to the lobby with George.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi, George.
So all the talk at Westminster is once again about a possible challenge to Jeremy Corbyn as Labour leader. And of course, this discussion has been going on even before he acquired the position. And the consensus among those who want to challenge him is that it would be wrong to do so before the EU referendum, which is a cause that many of them regard as far bigger, actually, than who leads the Labour Party. But some are increasingly confident that there will be a challenge after that point in the 4 week interval between the referendum and the summer recess. And there is still no agreed candidate. So there's been talk this week of Margaret Hodge as a possible stalking horse. In fact, has been talk for some time. And the logic there is that she's a veteran MP who's at the end of her career. She's independently wealthy, she's respected within the party, she's authoritative, she's Jewish, so that would give her a platform to challenge Corbyn's perceived softness on anti-Semitism. And the idea is that she would make the first move, soak up all the animosity from from the Corbynites, and then make way for the true challenger, say Dan Jarvis or Angela Eagle. But I think one of the problems for Corbyn's opponents is that they're still divided on whether now is the right time for a challenge and the form it should take. There's some who feel it's better to wait until later in the parliament when, in their view, Corbyn will have been given more time to fail and members will be more open to a challenge. A lot of shadow cabinet members I've spoken to, including those hostile to Corbyn, feel that the members would simply think it's unfair for him to be removed when he's had less than a year in the job, and when, in their view, he hasn't had time to set out his stall. They say they're anxious, they want reassurance, but they're not ready for another leadership election.
Yeah, and I mean, there are also, even among his most virulent critics, a feeling that it would be a great mistake to even have a coup attempt in the background in the run-up to the European referendum, which will further weaken the plotters' strength. On the subject of Europe, what is the mood in Westminster about that?
So that's taken something of a backseat ahead of the elections, which were imminent as are imminent as we speak. The polls show it's very close. I think it's fair to say that Barack Obama's intervention did not have the immediate impact that some expected, but on the Remain side, they believe that it's more of a gradual erosion of the case for leaving, and that they will ultimately win on economic territory.
Yeah. speaking of the local elections, what is the... So we know in great detail what the mood in Labour is. What is the mood within the other parties, the Lib Dems, the SNP, etc., etc., as we go into this period?
Well, I think the Lib Dems are just hoping for some signs of a fight back, something that they can point to, something which gives them some relevance again. Obviously, the SNP are in an incredibly commanding position, and in some ways, the real story in Scotland will be the battle for second and third place between Labour and the Conservatives. But it is striking in some ways that even when both main parties are hugely divided and have multiple problems, we're not seeing a surge for UKIP or the Lib Dems. Of course, in the 80s. When Labour last lost seats in a non-general election year in the locals, it was the SDP Liberal Alliance that was surging, and that's not the case this time.
Let's say the results are catastrophically bad for Labour. Will you think there will be any nervousness, particularly in the Lib Dems, that they are failing to capitalise, and we're not seeing a surge in popularity for Tim Farron of the kind we saw for David Steele in the 70s or the Gang of Four?
Yes, I think there will be. And I think given that Farron was actually never a particularly popular figure within the parliamentary party, I think there will be some anxiety among what's left of that section of the Lib Dems. But more broadly, I think expectations are so low that it probably doesn't matter for now. But you'll remember when it first became clear that Jeremy Corbyn was going to win, there was some like Jack Straw who predicted that the Lib Dems would have a Lazarus-style recovery, and that hasn't happened. In terms of Labour, I think it will undoubtedly help Jeremy Corbyn's critics if Labour do lose council seats, because they'll be able to point to that as a hard evidence of what they see as of his underperformance, of his failures. At the moment, they say the only numbers on the board are Jeremy's leadership election victory, his huge mandate, and the surge in party membership, two statistics which Corbyn invariably refers to every time he speaks. They will now be able to hammer him with the council losses. But of course, the comfort for Jeremy Corbyn is that all of the evidence we have to date, both anecdotal and cephalogical, suggests that the membership are as supportive, if not more supportive of him, as they were in September. So even if this challenge does happen, and there are plenty in Labour who actually think that there won't be a challenge at all, that the hurdle is too great, there is a strong likelihood that it will fail. And the view of some of the challengers is you keep hitting him and you gradually wear him down. But it does feel the idea that Jeremy Corbyn could be removed through a challenge that does feel rather optimistic at the moment. I checked actually last night, the last time a Labour leader was removed through constitutional means was in 1922. So Jeremy Corbyn's opponents don't just have to defy politics, they have to defy history.
Oh, and on that note, we'll be back next week. Right, so from one civil war to another, bomb, bomb, bomb. Captain America 3, Civil War, is out in cinemas. We are joined again by Henry Zeffman, who saw it this weekend. I, of course, saw it this weekend. And Helen Lewis, who saw it this weekend. So,
I'm just going to front this up by saying I did not see The Winter Soldier previously. I saw the original Captain America. I've tried to keep up with the Marvel movies, but there's
a lot of them.
Hundreds of the buggers. So I've seen Deadpool. I like that. I've seen some of the X-Men. I think I may have missed an X-Men.
X-Men and Deadpool aren't part of the same movie continuity as the Marvel films.
Yeah, but I'm just saying in Marvel type film. I know that's... But what I mean is... the point I'm making is there are a lot of films to keep up with, Stephen.
Well, I'm just saying they're not fundamentally, that's like saying I haven't kept up with all of the, I don't know, like Ian Fleming books, but I've just finished reading Harry Potter and The Goblet of Fire. They're not the same.
But I have. But that would be a true thing to say.
But they're not the same. Anyway, that's one in the eye for the podcast listeners who believe we agree on everything. Anyway, So there were, of course, all the numerous spoilers about Civil War. So if you haven't watched it yet, go away and come back when you have.
But this being the New Statesman podcast, what we're really here to talk about are the politics of
Captain America.
Captain America Civil War. So let me attempt to, this is going to go so badly, to give a brief précis of the plot. Essentially, everyone thinks that the Avengers are getting too big for their boots. They're acting like a sort of global police force. They've got no oversight. They don't report to a select committee. They don't go to Senate, so, you know, subcommittee hearings. And they're just basically doing what they want. In the last but one film?
Yes, in the last but one film.
They sort of accidentally trashed an entire city because someone was levitating it and they let it drop. And that was all great. But then people died. Another bit of land. So the city called Sokovia. So the premise of Captain America Civil War is that the US government tries to bring them under the control of the UN. And Cap doesn't like this because the Winter Soldier, who is an assassin who previously was bad but also good and his friend and rescued him from a river and had been frozen at the same time as him, was outside of this and he wants to rescue him and stop him being done for crimes he did not commit. Although he did commit other crimes, but he was brainwashed.
He's also against the agreement full stop. He thinks that if they are... he's like, well, what if we're told to go in somewhere we think we shouldn't be or we're told we're not? To go in somewhere we think we should. Effectively, it is like a classic, like a division on the left. On the one hand, you have the liberal tradition, your kind of Paddy Ashdown, Nick Clegg, Roy Jenkins, with Captain America thing. No regulation, let us help the helpless and we'll do it in our own way.
Paddy Ashdown would love to be compared to Captain America.
And then on the other hand, you have...
You see Paddy Ashdown's amazing shield.
You're kind of like big state... Gordon Brown, Tony Blair, Ed Miliband, Harold Wilson, kind of like, like the state, a more authoritarian, the state is going to tell you where you cannot intervene and not.
So what surprises me is the fact in this division that Captain America finds himself on the side of not being under the control of the US government, given that
he is literally a creation.
Avatar for sort of American triumphalism and exceptionalism. The fact that he then goes, well, I'm not doing what I do, what I want. I was surprised at the way that that goes. And so Tony Stark is the leader of the other faction who kind of says, we've got to, although mysteriously having lost Pepper Potts, presumably because Gwyneth Paltrow refused to be in anymore because she's got kale to eat somewhere. On the side of Captain America.
Yeah.
Henry, were you?
No.
Why not? Why are you such a stooge?
I mean, obviously, because I'm Jewish. But no, the reason that I was really on the side of Iron Man is because I agree. I find the idea of these superheroes, some of whom aren't even from Earth, in Thor's case, although doesn't make an appearance in this movie.
You've been xenophobic.
Literally from... Well, it's not quite xenophobic, right? It's oh, I haven't done enough
it's
Greek.
It's not racist to impose controls on superheroes.
It's not racist to point out that he's from Asgard, which is it's literally another realm. And so he probably needs some kind of human oversight, let alone American oversight.
You're the Simon Danchuk of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, I don't know who's Karen. I think it's quite straightforward argument. I mean, what's quite powerful about the fact that Tony Stark, this kind of swashbuckling, testosterone-addled, ludicrously intelligent inventor, is the guy who ends up on the government side because he has this very... corny, although it's kind of well done, moment with a mother of a guy who's been killed in Sokovia, which is the Eastern European state, which they lifted up and dropped on some other undefined landmass and killed loads of people. And she says, my son had dreams too, but, he's dead because of your actions. And Stark thinks, oh, yeah, that was bad. And the reason he thinks it was bad is because it was bad. And quite simply, the combined... I mean, actually, the only thing that I struggle with being Team Iron Man, Team Tony, Team Big State, Team Orwell, is that I don't really see why it's the UN. There are lots of countries that are quite bad in the UN. I'd probably be happier if it was just the American government.
All right, John McCain.
You want NATO control.
NATO is a good compromise. I mean, actually, they get the politics of it wrong because it's the UN who write these accords, but the only person they ever interact with is not some sort of Ban Ki-moon cipher. It's the Secretary of State of the US, which doesn't really make sense because he doesn't speak for the entirety of the UN.
And also the King of Wakanda.
And the King of Wakanda. Yeah.
I mean, so I think I also would say I was broadly on Iron Man's side, because ultimately, if like the problem with like Captain America's like, well, what if we were told to go somewhere we shouldn't? Well, then don't. Yeah, like ultimately, like.
But then you end up in a US Supermax floating fortress prison.
Yeah, but not for
it
very long.
It looked quite comfy as a prison, right?
Really small cells.
I had two questions about Scarlet Witch from the film, right? The first was, when everyone else changes into their battle armor, she changes into her corset, right? Which exposes more of her to bullets. But also, you can't put a corset on without help, right? And so she's escaping with this other guy. They're running, and she's like, wait a second, I need to change out of my regular clothes into my battle corset. Will you do me a solid and lace me up? That feels unlikely. The second is when she's locked up in the thingy-bobby, she's got, like, weird mind power. Wearing a straitjacket isn't going to stop her getting out.
I think the premise is that she can only do it when she can do the thing with her hands.
Well,
where she
her
could,
hands
so that's why they've got her in a straitjacket, so she can't put her... If she can only do magic when her hands are 4 inches apart. That seems to be the lesson of the film.
Okay. But really, they've put her in a corset because the people who make these films are sexist, right?
Well, I was trying to work out whether or not it passed the Bechdel test, and I think that's... I'm trying to think whether or not... Was there any chit-chat between any of the women...
Because Scarlett Johansson Black Widow never talks to Scarlet Witch about anything in the film, actually. And
well, they're on different teams, and then, because obviously, you know, they have to balance up the one woman on each side.
One woman per side, that's it.
Exactly, because there's only two to go around.
And then they're weird black valets.
I think they get one black guy per side as well.
But they also have like a black sidekick. Like, that's the thing, it's just like... I mean, I actually did think the fight between the superheroes was done really well. It was fun up until the point where they then very cleverly like go, no, actually, you need to be taking this more seriously. When Don Cheadle, who's Iron Man's black guy, gets shot by mistake when they're trying to shoot Captain America's black guy. Wow, this film actually, there are a lot of problems with it when you kind of think about it for a couple.
Well, can I tell you why I'm on Team Captain America?
Yeah.
Because I think that there, in everything like this, there are no right answers. And that you're making a kind of crude end justifies the means argument. You're always just trying to kind of come up with you have to do the least worst harm that you can in any situation. I think that either way, the Avengers are incredibly dangerous to humanity, but the best thing to do is for them to be personally responsible for that.
But if you want to do the least worst thing, then the least worst thing... I mean, the presumption of Captain America was that by submitting to UN supervision, they were going to do less in fewer places. He said that explicitly. So doing the least worst thing or the least bad things would presumably mean doing less.
Also,
generally.
People are really ungrateful. I mean, they literally saved New York from like a massive squid thing.
Yeah. I mean, like there was that bit where the US Secretary of State like played them a video of them saving the world 3 or 4 times. He was like, yeah, but look at this building collapsing. It's like, yeah, but look at the
literally,
world. It exists.
But I think the big difference is...
I'm still on his team, though.
Is then right, so like with the alien squid monsters, the Chitauri...
Hang on a minute, you're on the team that includes Martin Freeman's accent.
God, that was really bad. I mean, the guy who plays Spider-Man, who's introduced in the film, and is actually terrific, by the way, is English.
If a fetus.
And is, but you know, not much. Probably closer in age to me than you. He's really good, right? And his accent is great, and he's young, fetus young. Whereas Martin Freeman... who's done a very good American accent in Fargo.
In Fargo, right?
But then it makes you wonder whether the only American accent Martin Freeman can do is that really niche sort of semi-Scandinavian Minnesota thing. So they might as well have just got him to do that accent, because presumably some Minnesota natives do work for the UN.
But his
accent was terrible.
I did feel like essentially his Martin Freeman-ness was struggling to break through at all times.
I mean, it was Pete in the office suddenly like being the US Secretary of State's lackey.
Which would have been awesome.
Yeah.
And sorry, Stephen, I interrupted you.
Dawn would have preferred that life.
I can't remember what I was going to say before, but I'm just going to agree with Henry. So I would have preferred if Black Panther hadn't been kind of like Battle Mandela. partly because like he's a really posh African prince, which means he's either gone to Harvard or Oxford.
His
like,
accent
he's,
was
he's,
a
he's,
bit...
He doesn't sound like... He's not going to be like, I'm so happy to be freed. Like, that is not going to be his accent.
I am so happy you did that accent, yeah, not me.
Like,
do you think... They explained adequately the source of his powers. Do you think it needed more of that in this film?
I thought his power was just that he wore a cool black suit.
No, because he could sort of like fly and he also had claws.
What is the source of Black Panther's power?
Well, I don't know. There was a ring that he put on his hand.
Which also appears to be made out of the special metal that I really should remember.
I thought it was just that his suit was made of weird special metal and then the suit had claws. I don't know.
Can I also bring up, talking of these suits, how has actually Tony Stark got any money left? I mean, I know he's supposed to be incredibly rich, but surely there's only so much money.
Well, also, in an era
away.
Of record low global interest rates, you would assume in most times than Iron Man just has a vast empire of wealth. Which
but
he
what's
just
his wealth from? Because
now he doesn't
run a weapons business. What other businesses are that profitable? Is he running like
patents?
You know, is he run Facebook basically? Is that the only?
Oh, I mean, I reckon probably A, patents. B, he's now in clean energy. Right, there's lots of money in energy.
And a lot of subsidies from the EU, I bet.
Yeah, and also interest. You know, this is probably a guy with vast cash reserves. Like, probably he's started making iPhones or something.
He's almost certainly trying to develop a driverless car.
Yeah. And I reckon probably just interest, venture capital. Venture capitalists will give money to anything.
Do the Avengers take a salary, do you think?
They must do, right?
I mean, like, so what does the Vision do in his downtime? Because
he doesn't
really
need anything.
Anyway.
He doesn't need to eat anything, does he? Because he goes there when she's cooking
okay,
that paprika
like Hawkeye.
Thing.
What's the deal with his family? Well, like, who...
They just work. Well, they used to work for S.H.I.E.L.D., which obviously
doesn't. It doesn't exist.
But no, I think they clearly are all salaried professionals, right? Because like Captain America, we know from the one that Helen hasn't seen that he has a flat in Brooklyn. Mm. That must be.
Hawkeye's got a little farm, hasn't he? That his kids and his wife live on, and they don't really kind of get involved with that superheroing that he does.
Well, that must be a really weird experience, though, if you're frozen in ice for like 70 plus years and you've like grown up in like the poorest part of Brooklyn, and then suddenly it's
basically Bernie Sanders.
Suddenly
right?
It's Brooklyn. Yeah, I mean, he is basically Bernie Sanders. Like, you're Brooklyn
in a sense.
Aren't we all in a sense Bernie Sanders? I think I'm going to... Do you know what? At that point, I think I'm just going to have to draw a whole... What would be nice is I'm sure people will know more of the... Let's face it, people will know far more of the Marvel backstory. So where we go, well, I wonder what his backstory is. Someone is definitely going to tell us. And that's fine. That's what we love about our podcast listeners. But for the moment, Henry, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And now it's time for a section we like to call You Asked Us, where you ask us stuff. You can always send us questions either via email or via Twitter. We're at Helen Lewis and at Stephen KB. This week, people have been asking, what is the optimum time to get snacks and naps in while waiting for the election results?
Right, so your kind of prime sleeping time, and I would suggest is, if you can, I know lots of people asking this, are party activists, so I'm going to assume that you've been knocking on doors until around 10 o'clock. Your best bet then is if you can grab 2 hours and then you can tune in for when we'll start to get very early ideas about what's going on in Scotland and Wales.
So this is what, about 2 a.m. in the morning you'll start getting some of them?
Be about, 1, 2 a.m. when we'll start to get. There'll be kind of lots of sort of pre-coverage and kind of lots of fun stuff on the live blog. But
is this your live blog that you're running, Stephen?
Yes, my live blog.
You should have mentioned that.
Which I have failed to get corporate sponsorship from a food delivery company, saying is obviously the main thing I do during live blogs is eat. But you can safely kind of tune in 1, 2 o'clock when we'll start to get the first set of results from councils in England, the first set of results from Scottish constituencies, and then at about 2 we'll get a proper deluge of results from Wales.
Which will be really interesting because we will, first of all, trying to see whether or not Labour are going to have to go into a power-sharing agreement in the Welsh Assembly, whether or not UKIP have made any kind of... Well, they will make a breakthrough because they have very little representation at all there now. But the scale of that breakthrough will be very interesting to see.
Yeah, and I mean, there are lots of quite interesting things going on in Wales, not least the fact that Plaid Cymru have got stuck in this weird cycle where basically they get above a certain size, they go in coalition with Labour, and then Labour basically does a mini version of what the Tories did to the Lib Dems in 2015. And so now some people in Plaid are saying, oh, we just need to find a way of getting Labour out, even if we have to do a deal with the Tories. My personal view is those people in Plaid are crazy, and that would result in them being destroyed even more in the election. But from Labour's perspective, they would much rather do a deal with the Lib Dems. The Welsh Liberal Democrats have a very impressive leader in Kirsty Williams, and they are much closer to the Labour Party politically. So if the Lib Dems can get to 3 or 4 seats, and Labour can get in that 26, 27, then you can see how they could have quite a good, stable, liberal left government down there. So that's...
Okay, so then presumably you can have an early morning nap as well once you've checked in with the excitement of the New Statesman overnight news stories.
Yes, there will basically be a bit about 4 when you will safely be able to go to sleep till around 8, 9 o'clock, at which point there will be a kind of a raft of news stories from over the night, and then the mayoral results will start counting. My information, so last time the London mayoral count took a very long time because it was quite close. The expectation is, although people are still privately going, I'm going to fight till the end, the expectation on the Conservative side in a lot of quarters is, and they in fact have lost.
And presumably, I think it was you were saying that if it's designed on first preferences, that's a quicker count because you don't have to go through and count.
Yeah,
again.
I mean, I think it's highly unlikely that there is one poll which shows Sadiq like a point away from hitting the quota. But I think the thing is turnout dropping goes both ways. Zach Goldsmith we forget Boris had 2 great achievements in 2008.
So this is predictions that there will be what turn out to be about 35%.
Yeah.
It will be quite low.
So there won't be as many votes to count as there were with Ken B. Boris. And also, my instinct is what will happen is we'll have a situation at about 5 on the Friday when we'll be able to say, look, Sadiq has won, because he'll have 45%, 42% of the first round. And to be honest, in AV, I can find no record of a candidate securing more than 42% in the first round, not going on to win.
But then let's address the biggest question of all. When do the Police and Crime Commissioner elections report back?
So this thing is, you joke, but a lot of people did have actually emailed me about Police and Crime Commissioners, I think as some extended troll, but... so it's difficult to say, because they've never been held at the same time before, and they will be counted last. And you remember in the London in the European elections, when everyone else in the country was waiting for Tower Hamlets to get its act together and declare some results. And everyone else is... So the thing with the PCCs is it's like that. Bristol takes ages to count. It always has, and it probably always will. We're expecting them to declare on late on Sunday.
Okay, and when will they finish weighing the SNP's vote?
Oh, that will happen quite quickly. Although the lists, the mechanics of... So we will know who runs Scotland. Well... We will know who is opposing the people who are running Scotland, who is second in that kind of all-important third-place playoff between Labour and the Conservatives, probably 7-8 o'clock when the list vote will come into play. The interesting thing in terms of the drama of who comes first and who comes second is that the list system is designed to reduce down the iniquity of first-past-the-post, basically. But the difficulty is we are kind of assuming that neither Labour or the Conservatives will get any seats through first past the post, which then means that if there are maybe 10,000 votes separating Labour in second with the Conservatives in third, it's actually quite easy to see how the list system ends up helping the third place party in the popular vote slightly more. And so you end up with the third party coming second in terms of seats in Holyrood. So there's lots of exciting drama there.
You were talking and I was thinking about the fact that Spider-Man is only 3 years younger than Henry, and thinking that I might just waddle out of here on my Zimmer frame after this. But so far, thank you, Stephen, for telling... Well, I asked you, listeners asked you, and I think that was a pretty comprehensive answer, so thank you. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, with Stephen Bush. Our producer is India Bork, and our music is Devil with a Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. You can find us on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.